Gabrielle Union shares her thoughts on how Miami has shaped her life. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez.
I just fell in love. I fell in love during those 6 months that we were filming at Boys 2 in Miami.
The actress and activist has a new book out, Do You Have Anything Stronger? And she's hosting a special conversation with her husband, Dwayne Wade. It's at the Arts Center this weekend. We spoke with her about her time in Miami and some of the most powerful moments of her life. Also, belly dancing schools had to shut down like everything else during the pandemic, but Hanan Arts is trying to bring it back. We'll tell you about a social distance belly dancing workshop this weekend you could take part in. But first, is the government selling affordable housing in flood-prone areas? We take a deep dive into new findings from an NPR investigation. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. We all know flooding problems are only getting worse in South Florida. So why is the government selling homes in risky areas? Just in South Florida, the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development sold more than 230 homes in flood zones. That's according to a new investigation by NPR. Nationally, they sold nearly 100,000 properties in these hazardous areas over the past 3 years. WLRN's environment reporter Jenny Seletovich worked on the investigation, and she joins us now. Jenny, HUD's mission, my understanding, is to provide housing that's both affordable and safe. But would these homes in flood zones be considered safe?
Hi, I'm sorry, Luis. I didn't hear the first part of what you said.
Yeah, no. I was just saying that my understanding is that HUD's mission is to provide housing that's affordable and safe. But selling homes in flood zones, how's that safe?
Well, what they have is an elevated risk, right? So safe, I guess, is a relative term, but the risk is higher for these homes. Some of them are located in what FEMA considers its riskiest flood zone, which they say means there's about a 26% chance that they'll flood during the life of a mortgage.
And in your reporting, you mentioned that, well, excuse me, hold on, because I'm waiting for a couple of cuts to come in here. I want to jump in here real quickly, though, and skip through that. What does HUD do to keep these homes affordable? Let me start with that.
Well, so these are homes that HUD acquires in foreclosure. HUD provides the insurance for government-backed loans, so like loans from the VA, from Fannie Mae. So these are affordable loans to begin with. When they get foreclosed, HUD gets the property back, and then they put them back on the market. They have a tiered system where they say they first try to offer them to local governments or nonprofits. And if nobody bids on them, then they offer them to owner occupants, people who want to buy and live in them. And then if they still don't get any takers, then they offer them to investors. But I asked HUD specifically how they police that. How long are they available to these owner occupants or nonprofits? And they did not answer that question.
All right. So you spoke with, I was waiting to get this. You spoke with Roger Pardoe. He's a broker registered to sell HUD homes, and he's also the owner of the Realty Group of Miami. And this is what he had to say about who's buying these properties.
We have teachers, we have employees at the restaurant, employees at the bar, and they want to live close from where they work, especially when they have kids, to get to the schools, to get not too late, and to have a real life.
All right, so Jenny, what can you tell us about the people buying and looking to make these properties home?
Well, so I looked at property records for about 50 of the homes in South Dade, and I talked to some homeowners. The property records show that most of the homes are indeed, people claim homestead exemptions. So they are living in the homes they buy. The prices range from like $220,000 to about $300,000. So for South Florida, that is a bargain. I talked to one of the families. When they bought their house, the roof was falling in. It was in terrible shape. But the guy said, you know, they love renovations. He said, we don't go out, we do renovations. And he had painted his house, restored it. I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful home. And he had lived in Kendall, where he said flooding was worse. So he was quite happy. I talked to another guy, You had a young family, no concerns about flooding at all, even though the neighborhood he was in was one of the hardest hit by Hurricane Andrew. And a third person I talked to was a retired guy, been in Florida for 45 years, has grown kids, and he said he would not do it again.
So in your reporting, you mention how selling distressed homes could be lucrative in Florida. Locals are often also competing with investors who might be abroad, and of course, they're driving that price even higher. Let's go back to Pardo again. Here he is talking about that.
A lot of time that we have already 10 clients here, and the agent telling us, I already have an offer at 20, 30, or 40% higher than the asking price, and all cash.
So Jenny, what insight did he give you on the market and why people are willing to take this risk?
Well, I mean, South Florida is different than other parts of the country. The real estate market right now here is really hot. He said he would get to a listing and, you know, there would be, like you said, there'd be 10 people who had already bid on the house. And that includes a lot of overseas investors who are paying all cash. And when you have an offer of all cash, that usually tops anything that comes with a mortgage. So it's very, very competitive. And especially at these prices, when I looked at the property records, a lot of these homes in the time that they had been bought by from HUD had already been flipped and sold to another buyer at a pretty good profit of $100,000 or more.
And do those investors, I mean, again, because they're abroad, they may not even see the property. Do they know? Do they understand the flood risks involved?
Pardo says that they do. And the HUD lists the properties as is. You know, so you're buying them warts and all. I think what NPR found, though, is that a lot of buyers don't know that as is also includes being in a flood zone. Again, though, when I talked to Pardo, his buyers are well aware because the flood risk in South Florida have been so widely reported that that they are aware of the risk. They may not know what specific flood zone they live in, but they know it's out there.
Do any cities have any responsibility in elevating these homes or doing anything to fix the situation because they're in flooding zones?
Well, so there's a lot of what they call mitigation efforts going on right now and planning for that. The Army Corps has a plan they're working out with the county now that would include elevating homes in Miami-Dade. It's not clear because that plan's still being worked out where they'll be or how much it'll cost. The overall plan has been estimated to cost $4.6 billion, but that was when the Corps wanted to also build giant flood walls and floodgates. So we're not sure how that's going to come out, but cities closer to the water are looking at these mitigation efforts for sure.
And I guess, I mean, I think you touched on this a second ago, but I just want to make sure because the story kind of baffles me. I mean, is HUD transparent to the home buyers as to the state of the home, but especially again, how prone they might be to flood damage?
HUD does not specifically say that they are prone to flood damage. They just do the catch-all sold as is, which in real estate jargon, means that it's sort of a buyer beware.
Right.
You know what you're getting as is. I mean, I think the larger point here, though, is that HUD is right now, by selling these homes, a player in what's potentially a risky market. You've got one part of the government, HUD, selling homes in an area that another part of the government, the U.S. Army Corps, FEMA, is spending billions of dollars to deal with that damage and the cost of increasing flooding.
And you said that HUD hadn't responded. I mean, they said anything about this investigation at all.
They sent us a response to our questions. And what they have said is that millions of people across the nation live in flood zones and that the government is working to make them more resilient. And they say leaving the houses vacant would be another form of blight on the neighborhood that could bring down the neighborhood. And so they see it as their job to sort of stabilize neighborhoods. And they say make more affordable housing. The question is, like, how much of that in South Florida anyway is actually being sold to people for affordable housing and how much is going to investors?
I'm talking with WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. We're talking about this new investigation from NPR that found the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development is disproportionately selling homes in risky flood zones across the country. South Florida is one of the hotspots, by the way, for these sales. You can find a link to the full investigation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Jenny, you spoke with homeowners, as you told us, who weren't fully aware of what they were getting themselves into when buying these homes. What else did you hear from them?
Well, so was the one of the homeowners said that he didn't find out that he needed flood insurance until he was at the closing, and he was talking about the insurance that would be required, and says he was told then, like, oh, you're also going to need flood insurance. And he's the guy I mentioned before who said that he would not do it again, in part because these homes have all been foreclosed on, so many of them sat empty for a while. He said the other repairs were so costly, he still hadn't gotten around to them. And with the additional cost of flood insurance, it was just kind of a headache that he said he would not want to repeat this.
And that's something, as a reminder to folks, when you have to get flood insurance, I mean, what are those extra costs? How much more can that be?
Well, so another homeowner I talked to said that when he first bought the house, the insurance was $1,500 a year. And today, you know, it's 3 years later and it's up to over $1,800 a year, which may not sound like a lot compared to like windstorm insurance,
right,
but it's still an additional cost. And homes that are in flood zones where, you know, even on a afternoon rain, you get a lot of standing water, can have other problems like mold. You know, there are just other associated costs.
And it's not just affecting homeowners, it's also affecting renters.
Right. So our colleague Katie Swetolski-Munoz talked to a renter in Hollywood, and he, when they were walking around the house, showed her, you know, how high the water would get in his yard. And it's an inconvenience if you're renting, but you park your car in the driveway, you're responsible for your car getting flooded out, right? So.
And what else did they say about the fact that flooding is just getting worse in South Florida anyway, not just with these king tides, but with, I mean, sea level rise? How are they talking about that or thinking about that?
Well, the federal government definitely is thinking and talking about that. The homeowners, again, were aware that that we're in a floody area, and there's work being done, and like HUD itself said, that there's you know, a lot of work is going into the mitigation and making things more resilient. But the fact is that these areas are still getting a lot of flooding. The day I drove down to South Dade to get to one of the guys' houses, the road was flooded and you had to swerve into the other lane, and this was just a regular afternoon shower.
Yeah, and I wonder, too, I mean, does it depend on the city? Because, I mean, you think of it like Miami Beach is spending billions on their pumping system, and there's all this talk about seawalls and everything else. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, it definitely it depends on where you live and the kind of flooding that you get. And there are, again, City of Miami, Miami Beach are putting in much larger pumps to deal with the stormwater and getting it off the streets sooner. Other areas, you know, these western suburbs, people forget that they used to be Everglades marshes. One neighborhood I was in called Lakes by the Bay, the lakes are actually dredged to create the fill needed to raise the houses and the roads. So while we think of sea rise and the coast as being an area that gets more flooded, inland gets flooded just as bad, and it can sit there for much longer because there's no place for it to go.
And you kind of touched on this because, you know, you could have a fixer-upper in a flood zone, and that's still going to, I mean, you do that, you're going to increase the value of the home. And you spoke to somebody in that situation, and I wonder, what did they say? Does that make up for being in a flood zone?
He felt like it was worth the risk. I mean, he was quite happy with his, he bought the house for about $250,000 and it's over $400,000 now. And he said in the 3 years he's lived there, he hasn't seen a lot of flood problems. But, you know, yeah, I mean, that's a nice profit. But it's still, you know, he's in the highest FEMA flood zone that there is. But for him, it was worth the risk.
Overall, did you get a consensus from people? Are they worried, not worried about you know, flooding getting worse over time and what it might mean for them long term? Because, I mean, you're talking about this guy and he hasn't seen it yet. And yeah, it could go many years, but eventually it's going to happen.
You know, I asked him that specifically, and he said, you know, maybe it's for the next generation. I think that's what we all tend to think, like it's so far down the road, somebody else will deal with it. But I think I was just having a conversation today with somebody about this, and for people who've lived here a long time, I mean, we're seeing the impacts now. There's I don't think any doubt about that.
Oh, waiting for the next generation. First, let's not put it on them, but two, don't wait for that. I want to thank WLRN's environment reporter, Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Lewis.
And again, you can read more on this investigation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. And you know what? If maybe perhaps this story has touched you in some way, maybe you're part of this story, we'd love to hear from you. And you know one way to do it? Join the Sundial Text Club. Right now, just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. And that way you can share your thoughts on a story like this. Again, maybe it's affecting you and we want to hear your story. Well, still to come, we're going to speak with actress Gabrielle Union about her new book and her advocacy for the LGBTQ+ community. She's speaking at the Arts Center this weekend. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Gabrielle Union has established herself as one of the premier film and television actresses of our time. Her roles in Being Mary Jane, Bring It On, Bad Boys 2, and so much more launched her into the national spotlight. Union is also an outspoken activist for LGBTQ rights and for survivors of sexual trauma, and she uses her platform on social media for advocacy. Her second memoir is out. You Got Anything Stronger? It's available now. She'll be in conversation with her husband and former Miami Heat star Dwayne Wade at the Adrian Arts Center for the Performing Arts this Saturday night. Tickets are still available, and we've included their COVID safety protocols on our social media at WLRN Sundial. We spoke with Gabrielle Union earlier today. Your passion and commitment as a mother intersects with your activism, especially with your daughter, Zaya. She was assigned male at birth before she transitioned and announced her new name and pronouns, first to you and the family, before she went public. But what was that like, that process like for you and Dwayne Wade to understand her relationship with gender and your understanding of gender?
Oh, gosh. What it did was reveal how much we didn't know, how much we needed to unlearn. How invested we all seem to be in the patriarchy, and we all had to learn how to sort of divest from some of those older ways of thinking that had just been completely toxic and problematic and not accurate. So, you know, understanding the difference between gender and genitals, you know, gender expression and sexuality and identity, all of these things are vastly different. And if you only know what you know. So this process revealed to us just how ignorant we are and were, and that we needed to learn and learn fast and continue to learn and be flexible to evolve so we can be in our best position to guide and nurture and protect and understand our child.
You joined Zaya at Miami Beach Pride, which for many was the first time seeing her in public after she had announced her desire to go by Zaya and use she, her pronouns. Of course, being there for support. But what was that like for you watching her as she did go public and then how the public reacted?
Well, actually, it was before she came out as trans. She was not there yet. She was much, you know, younger. She didn't come out to us until she was in the seventh grade, and that was before. So that we were still living in Miami at that point. She didn't come out as trans until we had moved, and she was starting a new school in California. So, you know, we knew she was in the LGBTQ+ community. That was for sure. But what I had no idea that she had any kind of dreams about going to Pride. So it just so happened that I was calling to make a reservation for this drag show brunch that this restaurant does in Wynwood every Sunday. And when I called to make the reservation, they were like, "This is so wild. You know, would you ever be interested in joining us for Pride? We have a float every year, and this year's theme is Bring It On. And here you are calling, so we've got to ask." And I was like, "Well, you know, I have a date, so let me ask my date." So I asked Zaya, "Would you want to go to Pride and be on a float?" And she was like, "Oh my God, I always wanted to go to Pride." And I was like, "What? You've never said that." I'm like, you know, I've gone to Pride all over the world. My first Pride was at 8 years old when we moved to California, and my mom took us and got us buttons that said straight but not narrow-minded, with a little arrow pointing to our heart. So, you know, Pride has always been a part of my life, and I'd never thought Zaya, you know, was interested or, you know, even was aware of it. So to see her, you know, joy and passion about going, I was like, "Well, okay, absolutely, we're going to go." So watching her come alive on that float and be surrounded by, you know, the community, that was so beautiful. And, you know, because she had the courage to ride the float and be her full self, we wanted to make sure that she was supported. So we assembled her entire village, like the Avengers. There's at least 25, 30 people, you know, her family, her friends, teachers, tutors, coaches, and everyone walked alongside the float. So it was Zaya's, you know, big coming out moment, but it was also a moment for all of us, her support system, allies, to understand what it is, what it truly means to show up.
And you talk about that. I mean, your activism and your support for the LGBTQ community, you've been outspoken for decades about the support needed for them, but also for survivors of rape and sexual assault. One of the things in the book you talk about is how watching the ESPN documentary The Last Dance triggered memories of your assault, which occurred at the same time as the 92 Summer Olympics. So this week, you have members of the U.S. Olympic gymnastics team testifying to Congress about the assaults they experienced at the hands of the team doctor. How are you reflecting on that trauma as these young women have the courage to go up there and speak publicly about what happened to them?
Not only are they speaking publicly about what happened to them, as they've done repeatedly, they are now being tasked as victims with, you know, calling to task the FBI, who completely bungled the operation and led to more assaults that were, you know, that could have absolutely been prevented. It should never be up to the victims to call out, you know, members of law enforcement for not doing their jobs or bungling investigations. But yet here we are again with these young women after being, you know, brutalized for so many years, calling out for help, doing all of the things that we tell victims to do, and justice was delayed at best and non-existent at worst. Their bravery, their tenacity, it's I am in awe of them. I also share their rage at having to do this again and again and again and again. These are some of the best athletes in the world. And if anyone was going to be protected, you would think it would be, you know, young women like that. And yet and still, we just prove over and over and over again that we do not take sexual assault seriously. We do not value our young men and women who are brave enough to come forward. We show time and time again that we truly don't believe victims. So it is enraging, but it lights, you know, it keeps my fire lit that, you know, there is no rest for the weary, and we have to keep fighting. Lives are at stake.
I'm speaking with actress and activist Gabrielle Union. Her new book, You Got Anything Stronger, is now available. She'll be in conversation with her partner, Dwayne Wade, this weekend at the Arch Center. Tickets and more information on their COVID-19 protocols can be found on our website, WLRN.org. So you've written two memoirs, and, you know, you'd mentioned one of your favorite authors and cultural critics is Roxane Gay. We spoke with Roxane in December of last year as part of our book club, and she explained the, quote, strong black woman trope that she feels compelled to push against. Let's take a listen.
A lot of times people place these unreasonable expectations on black women that we can endure all and that we don't experience pain and that we are willing to be incredibly, that we're willing to take care of everyone but ourselves. And that's just not reality.
So in your work, you know, as an actress and as an activist in social media, how do you push against those tropes?
Well, I mean, for a long time, I didn't. A long time, I lived in fear of speaking up and speaking out. And I just kind of kept my head down and go along to get along type of thing. And what I realized, what that does is allow the abuse and the outright oppression, the problematic behavior to continue. And I realize that silence is complicity. And when they make you complicit in your own abuse, that's the opposite of strength. So I had to, over time, you know, a long time, a lot of come to Jesus's with myself, realize that the strong black trope is so damaging to black women because it makes us trauma mules. It strips us of our humanity. It robs us of our ability to have a full range of emotion and reactions and desires. Yeah, I mean she said it. She said it perfectly. It's enraging. it's enraging and it's mind-boggling how many times, you know, we all have to keep repeating this over and over and over again before we are finally heard and seen. And it's a daily fight, absolutely.
I want to reference a song just for a moment and how important this song is in your life. Take a listen.
When I wake up in the morning, love, and the sunlight hurts.
So anybody will know that's Bill Withers' classic Lovely Day. And to set the stage, you hear this in a hospital as a surrogate mother's about to give birth to your daughter. What's the significance of this moment for you, given the struggles that you had with pregnancy?
Well, that song for us it kind of sums up our journey. Our journey, you know, together as a couple, our journey as a family, our journey through fertility. So we played that song on purpose when we knew she was coming, because we wanted to bring her into the world in so much love and bring her into the family with love. And that song just, you know, captures that. But it was a song on a playlist that was created by Dwayne's longtime agent, Hank Thomas, who had passed away shortly before Kavya's birth. But, you know, while he was still alive, but, you know, knowing his days were limited, him and I talked a lot about music. That was our bond. And he sent me all of the, you know, his favorite playlists, and we would talk music and as a way to honor Hank and to make sure that our guardian angels were, you know, present when our new angel was coming into this world. We wanted to, you know, kind of combine those moments.
I would have finished with this is you spent a lot of time because of your career. You spent a lot of time between Miami and Los Angeles, but I wondered how this city became part of your identity.
Bad Boys too. I think, you know, because I became such a fixture and, you know, the arena and, you know, became, you know, such a part of Heat Nation and, you know, with my husband, you know, Wade County and all. But long before that, I was Sid Burnett, you know, angering, you know, people on both sides of the causeway, shutting down MacArthur Causeway. You know, having, you know, weeks off at a time due to Miami weather and LA people not understanding how to schedule, you know, film shoots in our glorious city. I'd have all these days off because of weather we wouldn't be able to shoot. So I just got in my little rental car and I would explore different neighborhoods and, you know, try different restaurants and practice my Spanish and just really immerse myself in the culture. And I just fell in love. I fell in love during those 6 months that we were filming at Boys 2 in Miami, you know, all those years ago.
So, and I'm wondering, as you're driving around exploring, what did you discover about yourself? What did the city help you discover about you?
Oh, God, that I truly do love diversity. So often I've ended up in cities where I kind of end up in the in certain bubbles that are not that inclusive. But I love it. I thrive off of it. And Miami is such a beautiful melting pot of so many cultures and languages and religions and just, you know, lifestyles and the language, the beauty of hearing different languages spoken in one, you know, as we're all trying to go get our Cuban coffee in the morning, you know, just all the different people coming together and the beauty of Miami, the vibrancy of all of these different, you know, communities coming together to make up, you know, all of these beautiful communities in South Florida and Miami specifically.
Gabrielle, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so much. And the book is fantastic.
No, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
And that was actress and activist Gabrielle Union. We have a link to her new book. It's called You Got Anything Stronger? On our social media at WLRN Sundial. And you can see her in person with Dwayne Wade Saturday at the Arts Center. Well, still to come, we talk with a belly dancer about bringing back the art form during a pandemic. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Before the pandemic, belly dancers were performing throughout South Florida. It wasn't hard to find a class or an event, but some of those courses and some of those performers had to leave when everything had to shut down. Hanan Arts is hosting a belly dance workshop at the Kubek Center this Saturday from 11 to 3, and there are COVID precautions in place. Joining me now, Tiffany Madera. She goes by the artistic name Hanan. Tiffany, great to have you back. It's been a while.
Thank you, Louis. It's fantastic to be back, and it's wonderfully flattering to be on after Gabrielle Union.
You get to follow after her, absolutely. You know, I was thinking about this. I mean, look, a lot of people were, so many businesses, so many performers, artists were impacted by the pandemic. And I wondered with you, one of the interesting things about your story is that you had these big events going on. You had so much going on. And then March of 2020 happens and everything shuts down for you. Tell me what happened. Take me back to that time.
Yeah, March of 2020 was just soul crushing for myself and the organization and all my colleagues and friends and artists around the world. I mean, in that 1 week when our city started shutting down and the world started shutting down, it's call and email after email just canceling the next, you know, 24 months worth of projects, performances, workshops, trips, conferences, film screenings. And really, you know, in the work that we do, you're working on something for well over a year before it manifests in public space. And so these projects, these performances, you know, they're like your children. It's a baby for you. And so in a very short period of time, it just felt like this death, you know, and then it becomes a metaphor and something very literal that happened, continues to happen with the pandemic. And just great loss. So the arts community, we've really felt this incredible sense of loss. And, you know, we're starting to get back on our feet. And, you know, we dancers are also trying to remix the scene.
And by the way, you know, you were telling me that you had filmed the event, and then it gets canceled, a big event, it gets canceled, and you want to turn that into a documentary, right?
Well, what ended up happening, which was just a fantastic opportunity and blessing, we had a performance scheduled for December of 2020, Hanan Arts, in partnership with Live Arts Miami, which we are partnering now with the workshop on Saturday. And we had a fantastic performance scheduled, live performance with the National Arab Orchestra. And what we ended up doing, with the help of the Hanan Arts Board and the generous partnership of Live Arts Miami, is we turned it into a documentary film, a musical documentary in, you know, the spirit of Buena Vista Social Club. And we took a signature song that would have been performed in that live performance, and we created an extended metaphor, Ya Habibi, the story of a song. And, you know, two of the Hanan Arts Board members, you know, jumped in to save the day to produce the film. Vivian Martel and also Gina Margillo directed the film, also a Hanan Arts Board member. And, you know, with the partnership of Live Arts Miami and the collaboration with the National Arab Orchestra and Michael Ibrahim, we, you know, we did make this musical documentary, which was a huge hit. I mean, we had 8,000 people in this, you know, digital screening. People all over the world, you know, watched the film, and, you know, it was a huge success. And that was the closing event for my Night Arts Challenge. So the Knight Foundation also played a big part in making that come to life.
So something good comes out of the darkness. That wasn't the only thing, is that, you know, because everybody has to pivot, and you did again this year with a program that you started called Shimmy Shift Pivot. And this is so fascinating, because it's these conversations, and they're really interesting conversations. But where did this idea come from?
Yeah, thank you. They are super interesting. Yesterday we had just a fantastic conversation with Rosie Herrera, and Shimmy Shift Pivot came out of last year, right? So last year, the world, the dance world, especially in the spaces that I'm in online, we were all trying to make sense of the world that we found ourselves living in, right? So we had this shared collective grief and trauma of a pandemic. We had the murder of George Floyd and this racial reckoning, and, you know, the voices of silenced and marginalized people all over the world were finally getting a seat at the table. And so Shimmy Shift Pivot was an attempt, or an intervention rather, because it succeeded and it continues to succeed. It's an intervention on giving tools and language to having these critical and important and difficult conversations. And what I observed in the dance community and other spaces is that these difficult conversations would result in cancel culture, outrage culture, shaming, and the conversations wouldn't lead to any healing or transformation. And the mission of Hanan Arts is using dance and film as a vehicle for healing and transformation. And so the Hanan Arts team last year got together, and we created a fantastic season of Shimmy Shift Pivot. And, you know, as I mentioned to you, dancers, we know how to work through pain. We know how to dance through pain. And Shimmy Shift Pivot is a play on words, right? So shimmy is like that signature belly dance move, the crowd pleaser, you know, the vibrations of the body. And shifting your weight, shifting your perspective. And then pivot was the big word of 2020. And so it's also something we do in dance. Mm. And so we've continued the program. We've amplified it this year with Live Arts Miami. And because of the vaccine, and because of there is more safety in the world, we can now add the in-person workshops, which are very important to the Shimmy Shift Pivot vision, which is to not just provide the intellectual, academic, thoughtful conversation, but also anchor it in the body and bring it into the body. And that's what we dancers know how to do. We know how to improvise, and we know how to create aesthetic solutions to difficult problems. So Saturday at the Kubek Center, we have a half day intensive where we will safely gather and really look at the themes of Shimmy Shift Pivot, which is about critical dialogue, which is about, you know, giving a geopolitical social context to the dance, and also using the dance as a metaphor to interrogate our own beliefs, ourselves, and to be in community, which is something we really, really need.
Again, I'm talking with Tiffany Madera. She also goes by Hanan from Hanan Arts. And as she's mentioning, there's a belly dance workshop. It's at the Kubek Center this Saturday from 11 to 3. We have all the details on our social media at WLRN Sundial. If somebody wanted to, Tiffany, if somebody wanted to take part in that, you know, what can they do? How would they do it?
So the best way is to register at www.livearts.miami.org, livearts.miami.org, and you will find all of the information there. And also the workshop is taking place at the Kubek Center, which is a cultural space, which is also part of Miami-Dade College. And
there are safety protocols in place too.
Yeah, so we will be wearing masks, we will social distance, we are working about making sure we have, airflow. And there's other Shimmy Shift Pivot in-person workshops that I have been doing. We had a fantastic workshop at Miami-Dade Kendall campus with the dance majors, the students of Professor Michelle Grant Murray, and we all wore masks and it was just fine. We all did perfectly fine. We felt safe. We got the work done. We had the dialogue. So I feel very confident that we are going to have a safe, connected experience.
And, the thing too, and we've talked about this before, is, you know, the beauty of the intimacy of belly dancing, but it can also be intimidating for somebody who hasn't tried it before. So what do you say to people who might want to go but they haven't tried this before?
Well, I definitely can understand that, because belly dancing is such a curious art form, because it exists in a very commercialized space. So there's a lot of images of belly dancing we see in social media. We see it in restaurants. So we don't get the full grasp of the depth and the power of what the dance can be for you. So Baladi, which is what we will be studying together, Baladi is a very specific aesthetic style within the large pantheon of what we know to be belly dance. And it's a woman's dance. So it's really about a woman's connection to herself and the world around her. And, you know, I have, 25 years experience or more as an instructor and facilitator of these types of workshops. So this is a very safe space. So we're going to look at a very particular dance vocabulary that comes from Egypt, that comes from a baladi style. So baladi means country style. It's a rhythm. It's a way of being in the world. We can think of something natural, connected to the earth, earthiness. So it's not a commercial, fast, glitzy style. It is a slow, personal, intimate style, like you said, that really navigates and travels this interior world of the dancer in relation to the external world. So I say, give it a chance, you know, and I have found that in the work that I do, my mission is to bring healing and self-knowledge and empowerment to the participant, to the dancer. So my approach is not a glitzy commercial approach that can be part of that intimidation of, you know, a visual landscape that has to do with commercial belly dance or the fetishization.
Right.
Yeah, of belly dance. It's really about the African diasporic indigenous origin with a social and political context. And that's where we're going to be, you know, working from. And I think it's very safe and very welcoming to all, yeah, to all people.
In this last minute here, I wanted to ask you, because going back to what you said before, is you have to plan things out way in advance. We don't know how long this is going to go. We don't know how long this pandemic will continue. But what are you planning for the future? What are your goals for the next year?
Well, it's a fantastic question, because now every creative session that we have is planning for the thing we want and then planning for what happens if we can't show up in person, right? So there's just this flexibility that our mind has to embrace. Hanan Arts, we feel so fortunate. We have you know, a multi-year project in the works, and it is a dance and film project. So we have these interventions about moving with technology, working with the camera, and telling stories a little differently. So we have plans to be on stage and to be in person in that shared
and
theatrical space. And we also have films in the works. We're in pre-production. So, you know, we're juggling, we're navigating, yeah, all of the variables.
And as mentioned, you have that workshop again coming up at the Kubik Center Saturday from 11 to 3. All the details are on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Tiffany, great to see you back out there performing. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Lewis. Thank you for having me.
All right. Again, Tiffany Madera goes by Hanan from Hanan Arts. Well, that's our program for this Thursday, September 16th. Coming up next week on the show, how are children dealing with the stresses of a new school year as the Delta variant continues to spread amongst young people? We talk about the psychology facing kids and the resources available. Plus, a groundbreaking new study is looking for gay and bisexual men to donate blood. For years, they've been excluded from donating blood dating back to the HIV epidemic. And could Florida follow Texas and pass a restrictive abortion law in the next legislative session? Because conversations are already underway with lawmakers, but it's likely to face some intense legal scrutiny. We're going to talk about that abortion law next week. By the way, don't forget our Sundial Book Club. We are reading Infinite Country by author Patricia Engel. You can always join the Sundial Book Club. Just go to Facebook, look up Sundial Book Club, ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. We're going to be talking with Patricia next Friday about the book. So if you've got questions, share it with us. And by the way, if you want to be part of the show in real time, join the Sundial Text Club. Just text in a question or comments about the show as it's happening. We got a text about today's show. Jorge Cantero, a real estate broker, texted in earlier in the show. We were talking about HUD selling homes in flood-prone areas in South Florida. And this is what Hart had texted into us. Quote, it's easy to fault a government agency without taking a moment to analyze. HUD is a reluctant seller. It becomes owner when borrowers of HUD-insured loans default on those loans. Municipalities allow developers to put homes in flood zones, and homes pay more taxes than undeveloped land. Developers are big political contributors, so that's why we see the move of the urban boundary development line. We need more construction jobs. That's the genesis of the problem. It is not HUD. HUD is not in the home selling business. HUD-owned homes are no longer affordable. They are a source of inventory for speculators and redevelopers who are fixing the homes, sell them using an FHA loan insured by HUD, and the circle repeats itself. That's fascinating. Jorge, thank you so much. He's a real estate broker who formerly managed HUD properties. Again, the text line, 786-677-0767. That's our program. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great Friday. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. As always, be good to each other, please. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.